Someone once came to Ananda and asked him, whose teaching is right, whose teaching is wrong? And so Ananda asked him to return. If someone teaches for the ending of passion, or if someone teaches for encouraging passion, which one is right? And the man said, well, the one who teaches the ending of passion. How about for someone who teaches the ending of aversion, or someone who encourages aversion? The man said, well, the one who teaches the ending of aversion. How about if someone teaches the ending of delusion, or someone who teaches encouraging delusion? And the man answered, well, the one who teaches the ending of delusion, that's the right one. So Ananda said, there you are, you've answered your own question. Someone teaches the ending of passion, aversion, and delusion, that's the person who's teaching is right. And the person who encourages passion, aversion, and delusion, that's the one who's teaching is wrong. You notice here that the rightness or wrongness is not a matter of persons, it's a matter of the quality of the teaching. But when we're looking to choose a teacher, we often have to look at the person who's teaching it. As another series of questions that the Buddha encouraged people to ask themselves when they go to see a teacher, to look at that person's behavior. Is this the sort of person who, through passion, aversion, or delusion, would claim to know something that he or she didn't know? And to know that, you have to watch the person for quite a while. Even then, it's not 100% sure, but at least you're heading in the right direction. We look at the Buddha, the way he behaved, the way he talked. He doesn't fit into a lot of our preconceived notions, maybe, about what a teacher should be. There's some portraits of the Buddha where he's just all sweetness and all light, very gentle, very kind, would never say anything harsh to anybody. But if you look at the record in the Pali Canon, there are times when he's extremely aggressive in his arguments. And he can be very harsh in his comments, especially with monks who've been misbehaving. And someone once called him on this. A group of Jains got their heads together and came up with a question: would the Buddha ever say anything displeasing to people? And they got a prince to ask him the question. They thought they'd get him either way, because if the Buddha said that he would say something displeasing to others, then they'd say, well, what's the difference between you and ordinary, everyday, normal people? What's so enlightened about you? And if he claimed not to say anything displeasing to anybody, they say, well, what about those comments you made about Devadatta? He called Devadatta a lick spittle, which is one of those terms you wish were revived, i.e. someone who would lick up someone else's spittle. So the prince went to ask the Buddha, but he realized it was late in the day and this was threatened to be a long conversation. So he decided instead to invite the Buddha to a meal the next morning. Then after the meal, he came and had his baby infant on his lap, asked the Buddha this question. According to the commentary, the reason he had the baby on his lap was if the conversation got difficult and he suddenly found himself in a bad spot, he might pinch the baby and the baby would cry, and then he could put an end to the conversation. But when he put the question to the Buddha didn't answer either way that the Jains had expected. He said, that question can't be answered categorically. And the prince realized right then that the Buddha had outwitted the Jains. And so he told the Buddha up front that he had been put up to this by the Jains. And so the Buddha then said, before he gave his answer, though, he gave an analogy. He says, this baby son you have here, suppose he got something sharp in his mouth. What would you do? And the prince said, well, I would hold his head in one hand, and then I would make a hook with my finger on the other hand and stick it in his mouth and try to get it out, and even if it meant drawing blood, so that he wouldn't swallow it and suffer even worse things. So the Buddha said, in the same way, there are times when he would see that it was the right time, the right place to say something displeasing. But it basically went down the list of things he would and wouldn't say. It comes down to this. The first set of questions is it true? If it's true, if it's not true, he wouldn't say it. If it was true, then it would go to the next set of questions. Is it beneficial? If it wasn't beneficial, even though it was true, he wouldn't say it. If it's beneficial, then he'd go to the next step. Is this the right time to say something pleasing or the right time to say something displeasing? If it was a pleasing statement but not the right time, he wouldn't say it. In other words, is it timely? If yes, he'd say it. If not, no. Notice those three terms: true, beneficial, timely. And he'd say, why is that? Why would he choose these things? It's because he has compassion. Because sometimes the truth is harsh. Or people need a harsh statement of the truth in order to understand it, in order for it to hit home. So that was the nature of the Buddha's compassion. It wasn't always gentle and always sweet. But he did have the well-being of the other person in mind. And the prince went on to ask him, he said, do you plan your answers ahead of time, figuring if someone asks me this question, I'll answer that way, or if someone asks that question, I'll answer this way? So the Buddha gave him another set of questions. Because you're known to be an expert with regard to chariots. It's kind of like nowadays someone who really knows cars. You can imagine princes knowing chariots. The prince said, yes, I'm well known as an expert in chariots. And the Buddha says, do you sit around thinking about if someone asks you about this part of the chariot, what you say, or if they ask you that part of the chariot, what they'll say? And the prince says, no, I just know the chariot. When the question comes, I immediately know the answer. And the Buddha said in the same way, he knew the Dharma that thoroughly. He didn't have to sit around and plan out answers to questions. And so it's through his knowledge of the Dharma that he knew which way was right and which way was wrong. He said, you know, there is a right path and there are wrong paths. And he knew that because he'd follow the path that got to the end of suffering. And he saw that there were some variations on the path. Sometimes he'd explain it in terms of the Eightfold Noble Path. Sometimes it'd be the seven factors for awakening, the five faculties, the five strengths, the four bases for success. But they all came down to the same thing. Each of them, as you analyze them, falls under the headings of the Eightfold Path. Slightly different variations in terms of which factor comes first, which factor comes second. But the basic path is always the same. The Buddha was like someone who's standing at the top of a mountain. He's tried all the paths up the mountain. He realized, okay, there's only this one path that actually gets to the top. People standing at the base of the mountain see all these paths going up the mountain, and theoretically, yes, it is possible that all the paths could reach the top. But when someone reaches the top, they know, okay, there was only one way that get up here. The other paths either just funneled into the one path or they just wandered off someplace else. So there's this uncompromising quality of the Buddha's teachings. As he said, when you reach stream entry, you know there is no other way than the factors of the path. This may go up against a lot of our preconceived notions nowadays. And not just nowadays. People had the the attitude in the past, that it should be true that all kinds of paths are true. So why should one person have a monopoly on the truth, they would say. Well, some people are more dedicated on others. Some people test things more rigorously than others. This one person asked the Buddha, are there many different versions of the truth? Is the truth many-faceted like that? And the Buddha says, no, there's only one truth. There are lots of what he called personal truths, but they're only partial. The word arya, arya satya, that we translate as noble truth. Arya also means standard, true across the board. When Supada came to see the Buddha on the very last day of the Buddha's life, that was the question he asked too. Are all the people who claim to know the truth teaching the truth? Are they lying? Or are they all awakened? And is only one of them awakened? The Buddha said, put that question aside. They'll teach you the Dharma. He taught him the Eightfold Path. He said, any teaching that contains the Eightfold Path will have people who are awakened. Any teaching that doesn't teach the Eightfold Path will not have anybody who's awakened. Notice he didn't say it was because whether the question was whether it was his path, his teaching, or somebody else's teaching. But there's a standard pattern all across the board. It's not a personal issue. It's simply a question of who tested the truth rigorously enough to know that this is the way to true peace, this is the way to true awakening, to the end of suffering. Now, for most of us, we're in the dilemma of we're at the bottom of the mountain. And there are lots of people with their paths, and they say, my path goes to the top, my path goes to the top too. And it seems nice and friendly and a good way to avoid conflict is to be open to the idea, well, maybe everybody gets to the top. But if you've ever been up a mountain, you know that not all the paths get there. It's like that old statement, all the rivers flow to the ocean. Well, they don't. Like the Humboldt River, the Sevier River, they flow into the Great Basin and just disappear. They evaporate. The river, the water in the rivers evaporates, becomes clouds again, rains again. So it means that maybe next time around that water has a chance to flow to the ocean, but not in that river. Maybe it falls into another watershed, gets down into the Colorado. Of course, nowadays even the Colorado doesn't get to the ocean. Gets down in those lakes between California and Arizona and evaporates again. Maybe this time it gets over into the Rio Grande watershed and it gets down into the Gulf of Mexico. So we all have the chance someday to get to the ocean, but it's not necessarily the case that every river is going to get us there. So we're stuck with that problem if we haven't been to the top ourselves. How do we know what gets to the top? Do we believe the Buddha? Do we believe somebody else? The Buddha said the only point in the practice where you really know for sure is at stream entry. So up to that point, you have to go on a sense of conviction, which is not totally secure. It's not totally guaranteed. The Buddha gives an example of the role of conviction. He says it's like the rafters of a house. The rafters are going to be secure only when the ridge pole is in place. You have to put up the rafters first. And then you put the ridge pole on the top. Because that's the way they did it in those days. And so conviction is like one of the rafters. And then you also have persistence, and you have concentration, you have mindfulness. It's only when you have discernment, which is the ridgepole, that's when the frame for the roof is secure. So the only way you can know the truth of the teaching is to put it to the test, and it has to be a rigorous test. As John Lee once said, you have to really be true to the teachings if you're going to find out the truth of the teachings. If you're not true to them, they're not going to be true for you. So you have to ask yourself, which teaching seems most likely to lead someplace important? You look at the people who practice it, you look at the teaching itself. And then you have to decide. And nobody can make any guarantees for anyone else, that no matter how much an enlightened person can say, it's true, it's true, it's true. He or she can't bring it out to show it to other people. You can get an intimation by looking at the person's character, but even then that's not proof. Although you see somebody obviously abusing other people, misbehaving, that's a sign that they don't know what they're talking about. But ultimately the only proof is when you actually see the Dharma inside yourself. So there's an element of risk-taking as you follow the path. But fortunately, when you look at the path, it's not a path that asks you to do anything shameful or anything in a sloppy way, in a harmful way. These are all good qualities to develop in the mind. Persistence, patience, endurance, mindfulness, concentration, discernment, compassion. The balance of these qualities as you develop them in the mind is a good thing. So you don't lose out. What you may lose out on are a lot of the pleasures that the world provides right now. Sensual pleasures. Everyday pleasures. But are those the things we're really born for? Are those the things that give meaning to life? As John Swart used to say, think of the sensual pleasures you had last week. Where are they now? They're just a memory. They go, go, go. And sometimes the memory is nice, and sometimes the memory is not so nice. When you think about how the pleasure is gone, or you think about the less than honorable things you did to get a taste of those pleasures. It's not like the happiness of the path. That's the classic statement, is it's admirable in the beginning, admirable in the middle, admirable in the end. The causes are good, the results are good, and the ultimate goal is good. So even though it may require some renunciation and some going without, the things you're going without are things that really don't have that much meaning or that much essence to them. But the qualities you build in the mind, those things are meaningful. Those are your treasures, bringing you happiness in the present moment and security for the future. So the choice is yours. What do you want to do with your life? What kind of life seems meaningful? The path has its ups and downs. Sometimes it gets discouraging when you seem to just go through these cycles, up and down, up and down, up and down. But that's because the rafters are still wobbly. If you take these ups and downs as a good sport, you'll find that you can get past them. And then when things are secure, you'll be glad you did.